യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാകരോത്ഥം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാത് വിവരണസ്യ ച. So, in the last few classes, we were discussing the obstacles for yoga and also the method of overcoming those obstacles, the practices. Those obstacles are called kleshas in general, which are common in spiritual life. The moment we start thinking of higher spiritual life, we feel some obstacles, not only psychological obstacles in the form of thoughts, thought currents, tendencies and impressions, but also even physical obstacles emerge and we have to confront them. In a very general way, these obstacles or distractions are called avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha. As we already mentioned, our whole mental life is analyzed by Patanjali in the second chapter, that is sadhana pada, in the form of three important factors on the basis of three important elements. One, the experience that we undergo, sometimes happy experiences, sometimes unhappy experiences, sometimes things that create fear, things that create dislike, things that create strong liking and dislike, and so on. Those experiences are called technically in Patanjali's language as bhoga experience. And the way we react to those experiences, our emotional, psychological, volitional reactions all together are all divided into two general categories. Some reactions which are attractions towards things we like, we love, and their opposite reactions towards things, experiences that we dislike, we hate, raga and dvesha. So we have to keep this in mind. Our mental life, if you analyze it, our mental life, at the central point, experiences, internal experiences and also external experiences. And those of you who are familiar with the subjective idealism, not of Berkeley, but of the Buddhist tradition, which is called Yogacara system. Everything happens in mind. External objects have no ontological reality independent of the mental impressions they create in our mind. Things exist in the external world only in relation to the images and impressions they create in our mind. Mental system is called chittam in the language of the Mahayana Buddhist school of Yogacara, or it's called Vijnanavada, which is in a way a much more elaborate and profound form of Berkeley's subjective idealism. Because Yogacara system developed a highly profound and well-structured metaphysics, logic, cosmology, and also a highly developed epistemological system with its own hermeneutics. I'm not going into those details. According to them, of course, there are two fundamental schools in this older form of Yogacara system. One is sometimes called Svatantra Vijnanavada, and its later form is called, the earlier form is called Alaya Vijnanavada, the later form is called Svatantra Vijnanavada. I didn't teach these things for quite 2-3 years, you know. So there are two levels, two stages in the development of subjective idealism, that is Yogacara system, among the Buddhists. And incidentally, these are one of the two schools of idealism in Buddhist philosophy. The one school is called Shunyavada, or the doctrine of emptiness. The other school is called Yogacara system, or Vijnanavada, which sometimes technically is called subjective idealism. But traditional Buddhist scholars, the Buddhist Orthodox scholars, most of them in China or Japan or many of the Far Eastern countries, or in India also, those who are familiar with the Sanskrit text, won't agree with you if you tell them that your Yogacara system is a kind of subjective idealism. So that you have to keep in mind. In fact, I'm using a philosophical term that's popular in modern Western thought, which comes very close to the Yogacara system. Now, there are two stages in the development of the Yogacara system. One is Alaya Vijnanavada, the other is Svatantra Vijnanavada. It is very important to remember this to get deeper into Patanjali's system of yoga. Because Yogacara literally means those who practice yoga. Some of the most profound commentators on Patanjali's system were Buddhist monks, Buddhist bhikshus. Many of them were, Vijnana Bhikshu was a Buddhist. Many of them were Buddhists. Some of the most profound commentaries on Buddhist, on Patanjali yoga system were written by Buddhist scholars. Okay, now coming to the subject, as I said, there are two levels in the evolution of the Yogacara system or Vijnanavada. One is Alaya Vijnanavada, the other is Svatantra Vijnanavada. According to the earlier system, there is an eternal subject and there are changing objects. So Alaya is the platform, Chittam. And there is Pravritti Vijnana, which means independent units of experiences which come and go on this platform, which is called Chittam. So the subject is real. Objects are only momentary flashes. Objects have no existence, no ontological reality, independent of the subject. Subject is real. Objects are momentary, therefore they are not real. Objects can exist only so long as those objects are perceived by the subject. Subject is permanent. Objects are impermanent. Objects are called Pravritti Vijnana. Alaya means house, repository, a place where you live. So all these external images and impressions, they come and go and they flash through this platform, which is called our Chittam, mind stuff, Alaya. That's a term used. Now, this was the school of Vijnanavada according to Vasubandhu and other earlier Yogacara. Bhumi was a famous book. There are innumerable ancient Buddhist scriptures written in Sanskrit language. Many of them are Vedantins or Vedic scholars, these authors. They were converted into Buddhism. So what they did, they tried to put the Upanishadic philosophy in their own Buddhist terminology. That's why many modern Buddhist scholars of the Vajrayana system, of especially those Buddhist scholars who later wrote books in Chinese or Japanese or Far Eastern languages, they sometimes say these ancient Brahminical scholars who were putting all Vedantic ideas in the language of Buddhist terminology. So that's a different matter. So the first stage of development was Alaya Vijnana. The second stage of development in Vijnanavada is called Swatantra Vijnanavada, which is very funny because according to them, subjects are unreal, objects are also unreal. Now, who perceives the unreality or the momentariness of external objects unless there is an unchanging permanent subject? Impermanent external experiences which come and go can exist only if they are perceived by a subject which is permanent. So their philosophy became very vulnerable. They said external objects are unreal, the subject also is unreal. So they cancelled alaya, a permanent platform on which all these external impressions come and go. Now, coming to the subjects, to our own subject. We already discussed here this avidya smita raga dvesha abhinivesha. Now, these are the kleshas or obstacles. And all these obstacles together, kleshas, should be studied in the light of these three elements. One is bhoga or experience. The other is our reaction towards those experiences in the form of raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes. And a third factor, which are somewhat related, that is bhaya or fear, moving away. So when we experience something, either we develop a liking for it, raga, or we develop a dislike for it, dvesha, its opposite, or we have neither liking nor dislike, but something related to dislike, it is called fear, we move away from it. Those which we like, we get drawn towards it. Those that we dislike, we avoid it. Those which we fear, we move away from it. That's how our mind reacts to external experiences. This is how Patanjali analyzes the world of human mind, or rather, the whole phenomenon of mental life. Now, he says, In the next verse, in the next sutra, he makes a statement. He says that avidya is the fundamental cause of all other problems. Avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha. Avidya is ignorance. Asmita is egotism. Raga is extreme liking. Dvesha is dislike. And abhinivesha is fear out of dislike. And he says, all these kleshas, all these problems emerge from one single factor. And that is avidya, our ignorance of what we are. When we interpret ourselves, when we define and understand ourselves as just a psychophysical entity, we are within the jurisdiction of likes, dislikes, fear, and so on. So our total lack of our own true identity is ignorance. That's the main cause of all the problems. So Patanjali puts forward a very interesting idea. If you change your own idea of what you are, the problems are solved. If we start looking upon ourselves from a different angle, from a different perspective, all the problems are solved. If you interpret yourself as a physical entity, then even a pinprick, even an ant bite, can be terrible for you. But those who are slightly more evolved, thinkers, painters, musicians, even philosophers at a higher level. Suppose you are reading, you are a painter, you are a musician, you are writing you are composing a poem, and if an ant bites you, you won't mind. All right, it doesn't matter. Even if there's a headache, if the headache is not too severe, you can enjoy drawing a paint. You can paint a picture. You can sing a song. You can read some interesting novel, at least, if not highly philosophical works. You may not read Aristotle or Kant, but you may read at least P.G. Woodhouse, at least, which means you are slightly above the physical level. So, but the moment you go even beyond, you transcend even beyond the psychophysical mechanism, the psychophysical interpretation of our own what, or our own understanding of what we are. And then, if you interpret yourself as Atman, as an all-pervading divine consciousness, then what we normally take to be tragic events are no more tragic. Extremely painful events may not be as painful. That means our experience is very much dependent upon what we think we are, how we interpret what we are. So we have to lift the level of definition that we give to our own sense of self. Once we get it, we get out of avidya or ignorance. This is Patanjali's understanding of avidya. Avidya has got much higher meaning and definitions in Vedanta philosophy, which is a bit much little more profound. Perhaps it is interesting to know. You know, avidya, according to Vedanta, is not just absence of knowledge. It is not just absence of or understanding of what we are. It is a philosophical, spiritual category. So ignorance, as we understand by the English word, is a very inadequate translation of what avidya really is. See, vidyade na iti avidya. This is the Sanskrit definition of avidya. That which doesn't exist is avidya. Now, when do we use the word "it doesn't exist"? We don't use this term in relation to something which is even inconceivable. It is not correct, we say. Now, suppose you use the word, I'm not Jesus Christ. Or to say that you are Jesus Christ is wrong. We don't make that statement unless you want to get certified by psychiatrists. But you can say, well, I didn't come yesterday. I didn't know that. When there is a possibility, at least a distant possibility, of your knowing about something, and you say you don't know that. That's the context when we use the word "I don't know." When there is a distant possibility of your coming, and if somebody asks you, "Did you come?" you say, "I didn't come." So the word avidya cannot be used in relation to something which is totally inconceivable. I can make this idea more clear from in the light of a great Upanishadic statement which Shankaracharya wrote an elaborate commentary upon. So he is Vacharambhanam Vikaro Namadheyam Murtigetiva Satyam. This is the statement in the Chandogya. The meaning is this. Well, suppose you have got 1,000 utensils made of clay, glasses, pots, pans, different things, different utensils. And somebody comes and tells you, well, is different from the other. A pot made of clay is totally different from a a glass made of clay or a bigger vessel made of clay, you would say, no, you are wrong. Vacharambhanam vikaro namadheyam murtigittiva satyam. Clay alone is the truth, and all these 1,000 utensils that you have made from that clay are different names and forms. When you make a utensil in one form, smaller in size, that you use for drinking water, you call it a cup or a glass. When you use a bigger vessel, when you manufacture a bigger vessel from the same clay, you call it a pot or a vessel. When the same clay, when it takes one form, is called a glass or a cup, and the same clay, when it takes another form, is called a vessel or a pot. So these distinctions and differences are only apparent, not real. Because you break the pots and pans and glasses and cups, they go back to the clay form. So, and before they were manufactured from the clay, they were in the form of clay. So what is the reality? The only clay. Names and forms are different. Similarly, the truth is that names and forms may create the wrong notion that a pot made of clay is totally different from a cup made of the same clay. So you would say these distinctions are only apparent, because there is a possibility of your misunderstanding things in a different way. You may, out of your ignorance, may argue that a pot made of clay is in every respect totally different from a glass or a cup made of the same clay. So somebody would tell you, no, you are wrong. It is the same thing. So when we use the word avidya, it is only in relation to a possibility of mistake. We don't use these terms in relation to something which cannot be even conceived of as an idea. So avidya is a fundamental category in Vedanta. So, because Vedanta does not accept the theory of evil, Vedanta explains the problem of the one supreme reality appearing as manifold thing, manifold universe, with the help of one doctrine, and that doctrine is the doctrine of error. By mistake, due to our misunderstanding of what we are, what the absolute reality is, we say this world is real, just as a child who may think a pot made of clay is totally different and distinct from a cup made of the same clay. So it is theory of error. Vedanta does not accept the theory of evil. Vedanta does not believe in anthropomorphism of evil. By positing a devil or a Satan, Vedanta says we make mistakes not tempted by archangel or Satan or the devil, but because we do not understand our true nature. We are the Atman, we are the all-pervading reality, and the whole creation is nothing but one supreme divine principle. Once we realize this, all the problems will vanish. This is Vedantic explanation. But yoga philosophy does not go that far. Yoga philosophy, according to them, yoga, according to Veda, yoga, avidya, or a kind of cognitive error, is only a function of the mind. It is just a cognitive error. It is, I mean, the yoga philosophy gives a comparatively superficial interpretation to the concept of ignorance or avidya. So anyway, Patanjali makes his point very clear, and that is true from Vedantic standpoint and also from yoga standpoint. According to yoga, avidya or ignorance is a cognitive error. Because of that, we become slaves to likes, dislikes, fear, attraction, aversion, and so on. Once we understand that we are that Purusha, the one reality, which is totally untouched by these fluctuations, we become free. That is the main point to be kept in mind. Now, after this, there is an important discussion in the Samadhipada. That is from the 30th Sutra onwards, it begins. I already touched upon this, but I will continue the discussion that we just started last time. What are the psychological problems of a practitioner in yoga? We already discussed this, and later Patanjali is going to discuss what are the methods. How do these problems manifest in our interaction with our neighbors, with our friends, with people under whom we have to live, we have to work in our everyday professional life? How do these problems manifest in our day-to-day life situations, in our interaction with our neighbors, friends, and people among whom we live? What are the reactions that mind projects, and how we can counteract, we can cope up with these problems that emerge in the mind? So I shall recapitulate. The 30th Sutra of Samadhipada, Patanjali gave a list of 9 psychological problems or obstacles in the path of yoga. We already discussed this in the last class. Vyadhi, Sthyana, Samshaya, Pramada, Alasya, Aviradi, Bhrandi Darsana, Alabdha Bhumigattvam, Anavasthitattvam, etc. These are the 9. Chitta Vikshepaha, Te Antarayaha. These are the distractions, obstacles, problems that we have to encounter in the path of yoga, which are also common in the life of any spiritual seeker when you suddenly start trying to practice meditation, reading of holy scriptures, discussing spiritual topics. Some of these problems may manifest. They are, first of all, disease. It could be mental diseases, again in the form of extreme attraction towards something. And if you are attracted towards something, then you will be naturally be averse, hostile towards something else. It's opposite. And fear. And when we are always moving like a pendulum between two psychological extremes of likes and dislikes, that tells upon the mind, on the body also, psychosomatic problems. Because when mind is always moving from one extreme to the other extreme like a pendulum, that affects the physical health also. So vyadhi means diseases, mental problems, and their effect on the physical health. Then, of course, a kind of languor, then indecision. Languor means a kind of mental impasse. We can't do anything. You suddenly feel it's a state of mind. You have traveled some distance, you have made some attempt, but suddenly the mind slows down. There is a laziness, a heaviness. And suddenly, that's why many spiritual seekers, after some time, suddenly there is a lapse. They want to relax their mind and they start going to undesirable places and all that. Sudden distractions. When you suddenly start taking extreme steps in spiritual life, suddenly mind feels a kind of heaviness and a tendency to move in the opposite direction. Patanjali says, you should know these problems. Once you know the problems, then problems cannot affect you. The enemy will keep away from you if the enemy knows that you know him or her. Once the problems are well known to us, when we become aware of them, then they don't appear to be problems. They may emerge, but we will be able to counteract instinctively. Then indecision, carelessness, sloth, lethargy, then suddenly, as I said, sensuality. This is the main thing I mentioned. People who take to spiritual life, suddenly there is a tendency for the mind to move in the opposite direction. They want to let off the steam. So it happens. So at that time, some of the commentators are given a method. They say, when you feel this heaviness or opposite mental drives trying to influence the mind, taking you away from the path of yoga, then you should divert your mind towards some intellectual mental pursuits which may not necessarily be part of your spiritual life, but which will never be harmful to spiritual life. If you cannot meditate, read the lives of saints and sages. If you cannot read them, then read some philosophical books. Somehow to keep the mind on a high ideal. In fact, that subject will be discussed just now after one or two sutras. I mean, how to keep the mind on a single high ideal, which is one way of counteracting the distractions and obstacles. Then Bhrandi Darshana, mistaken notion. Then Anavasthitattvam, missing the point. Then instability and so on. All the distractions. And in the next sutra, we already discussed this. That's why I'm going a bit too fast. In the next sutra, Patanjali gives four external manifestations. How these psychological problems manifest in the external way, externally. Sorry, dukkha, darumanasya, angamejayatva, shwasa prashwasaha, vikshepa sahabhuvaha. They are the byproducts of these nine distractions or obstacles that we discussed earlier. Sorrow, pain, despair, shakiness, and then the breathing system becoming irregular. Inspiration and expiration. Okay, now these are the problems. We already discussed this. Now today's subject is totally different, but connected to this. Here we are not dealing with problems, we are dealing with solutions. In the 32nd sutra of the Samadhipada, Patanjali gives one clue. I mean, how to counter these obstacles. I mean, this mental laziness, indecision, sloth, lethargy, a feeling that, well, we are not making enough progress. All these problems, a tendency to move away from spiritual pursuit. In fact, this tendency is portrayed by the great Christian mystics as temptations of Satan. In the autobiographical writings of St. Teresa of Avila, you find in a highly spiritual, highly psychological, with a profound insight into the human mind, the mind of any spiritual seeker. Suddenly, the flashlight is turned towards oneself. No wrong thoughts are coming to me. I feel the emergence of undesirable tendencies and thought currents. All these are interpreted as temptations of Satan or the devil. Patanjali's system is a little different because Patanjali does not accept the anthropomorphization of the evil. Rather, Patanjali does not believe in devil. What he says, these are the tricks that the mind plays upon you. Both ways are correct. When you feel that Satan is chasing you, well, you feel extreme urge to surrender to God, that is helpful in spiritual life. But you should not overplay the role of Satan, lifting him to the ontological reality equal to that of God. That should not do. That's the only thing. So, the point is, Patanjali says, these are the tricks that mind plays upon ourselves. So he says, tat pradishedartham ekattu abhyasaka. Now, how to counter these problems, psychological problems and the 9 psychological problems and their 4 external manifestations? So he says, tat pradishedhartha means to counteract these problems, psychological and physical problems. We should meditate on a single principle, a single idea. Stick to one method. Stick to one principle with a strong sense of renunciation for external worldly pleasures. Because the moment our mind gets established in the ideal of renunciation of external pleasures, renunciation means not being swept by our feet. Not being enslaved by the temptations of worldly pleasures. When we are able to control our senses, and when we do not allow ourselves to be controlled by our senses, it's possible by practicing the ideal of renunciation. And continuously, it's abhyasa and vairagya. So we should try to focus on one central idea. He says, if you could do that, then these problems can be solved. Now, this has 2 dimensions. One in spiritual life, one in normal human life. Even in normal human life, if we can keep in our mind one central theme, one great high ideal, even if you try to become a great musician, a painter, a poet, or anything which needs some effort, not at physical or sensual level, but at a higher intellectual, aesthetic level. That's one way of restraining the problems and conserving the energy and focusing the energy in a creative, constructive manner. But then there are some other problems. We are not living in the age of Patanjali, where people were practicing all this in the forest hermitages. He had the luxury of choosing his own forest and maybe constructing his own hermitage and living there, surrounded by people, teaching disciples and students who were fully qualified to learn all these wonderful things. But how do they relate to our own life when we are not living in forest hermitages? In fact, in the 33rd sutra of the Samadhipada, there is a very profound description of how to interact with the external world, not only situations, but human beings who may not be practitioners of yoga, who may not have any interest in spiritual life. We deal with all kinds of people. So in that sutra, which is very famous, Patanjali says, Maitri Karuna Mudida Upekshanam Sukhadukha Punya Apunya Vishayanam Bhavanataha Chitta Prasadanam. How to acquire mental tranquility? Chitta Prasadanam means a state of perfect serenity of mind, mental tranquility. Not inaction, not at all. When you reach that level of chitta prasadana, mental tranquility, mental serenity, you don't feel the urge to be always engaged in action, but you won't be lazy. We will be able to act with perfect serenity and tranquility. and we'll be able to keep quiet with the same degree of tranquility and peace, inner peace. That they both are very important. Those who are sitting quiet, doing nothing, we don't know whether it's out of laziness, ignorance, or serenity. So, the point is this, how to achieve Chitta Prasadhanam? He says, there's one technique that we have to employ, we have to use, not in a hermitage, but while working in the office, in the factory, or anywhere. Even when you go to markets, you can use this. Even when you go to Trader Joe's, you can use this. He says, there are different types of people in the world. There are those who are good, whose association will help you in spiritual life. Those who are virtuous people, who lead good life, whose association will enrich your own life, and who succeed in life, who are in a very good position. You should be able to enjoy when others are happy. We should be able to feel happiness when others are happy. See, there is an interesting dialogue in the Mahabharata between two great sages. The discussion is very profound from the standpoint of behavioral psychology. Psychology in general. The discussion is this. Who is your best friend? How to test whether a person is your best friend? Now, two examples are given. One friend is very sorry, very sad when you have a problem. And he comes out, helps you out of his way, gives you money, helps you out of these problems. Another friend is very happy when you are happy. When you get a promotion or when you get a higher position, another friend is extremely happy. Who is the best friend? So the sages replies, the one who is happy when you are happy, your best friend. Not necessarily the person who is unhappy when you are unhappy. Because the person who helps you when you are sad, when you are unhappy, may not be happy when you are happy. When you are in a miserable condition, he gets an opportunity to show his compassion. He's very generous. So he has got sincere compassion for you. So he's ready to help you out of the problems. He's very helpful. But the same person may not be happy when you reach a position higher than him. At that time, that person may feel a bit unhappiness. That fellow has gone beyond me. So who is the real friend? The real friend is the one who is happy when you are happy. The other one may be your real friend, but you have to wait for some time before coming to judgment. So the real friend is one who is happy when you are happy. The one who is unhappy when you are unhappy. The one who comes out to help you out of compassion may not necessarily be an ideal friend. When you are happy, when you reach a higher position than him, he may become slightly unhappy. It is possible, not necessarily, but there is a possibility. So that sage, say Maitreya, says, the real friend is the one who is happy when you are happy. So one definition of Ishvara, God, in the Patanjali Yoga system itself, in the commentaries, Ishvara, according to Patanjali, is not the monotheistic creator God that we understand in Abrahamic tradition, or the Brahman or Atman, the all-pervading, immanent, omnipresent, divine principle, according to non-dualism. No. According to Patanjali's system, Ishvaras are those who have reached the highest yogic experience, those who have gone before us, reach the highest spiritual truth. There are many like that. It is a dualistic philosophy. Patanjali system is essentially dualistic in his ontological, metaphysical conclusions. So the subject is this, Maitri. I mean, you should be able to be happy, you should be able to enjoy when others are happy. Even that person may not know you are happy because he is happy. Without his being aware of your your happiness, your inner joy, when he is happy, you should feel that happiness. That is supposed to be a characteristic of Ishvara according to Patanjali system in the commentators. So when others are happy, you should be able to feel the same happiness, sukha. That is the mind. So he says, the next work characteristic is, when others are unhappy, when they are suffering sorrow or sadness, you should be able to feel the same sadness. Of course, along with that, you should also be able to enjoy happiness when others are happiness. Both should come together. So, another characteristic is of a person who is enjoying inner serenity and mental tranquility, or the way to enjoy mental tranquility and serenity is to practice happiness when others are happy and to practice compassion when others are going through a hard time, when they are going through a period of sorrow, sadness. And then there are those who are superior to us. Punya, he means those who are virtuous, those who are endowed with higher spiritual characteristics and qualities than us. We should have sincere admiration for them, for those who are superior to us in spiritual growth. And what about those who are not interested in spiritual things, spiritual practices, those who are evil by nature? You should not be happy with them. It's dangerous. You should not be friendly with them. You can be happy, but don't show your demonstrate your happiness. That's what Patanjali. Upeksha means indifference. You should not demonstrate your Advaita, your non-dualism, your universal love by joining them, because every chance that you become one among like that. So, because there are some very powerful evil personalities with tremendous persuasive power. A man like Hitler, just imagine. He could practically sway over the human minds, control. He could manipulate human minds. He could lead a whole nation, his intelligent, educated people, like a flock of sheep. Tremendous persuasive power. Scourges of humanity. So if you try to, because there is an Atman in him also, then if you go with him, you are more likely to become an SS man. So that's why he says, you should be indifferent. You should not go near them. But you should not hate them, because hatred creates an inner problem. Hatred upsets the mind. Hatred disturbs the tranquility, inner peace. You should not go near, because that could take you away from your spiritual path, can disturb your mind, can disturb the inner tranquility and peace. But you should not hate them. Even hating evil men creates a subjective problem within our own mind. Hatred for anything, hatred for even against an ant, being a hostile feeling against an ant, a fly, may not do any harm to the fly, but could harm our own mind, because it disturbs the mind, tranquility, peace. Therefore, Patanjali says, total indifference, keeping a long distance. Swami Vivekananda, in one of his lectures, not on this subject, maybe in Bhakti Yoga lectures, he says, there are some people who are very powerful mentally, strong iron willpower, but a scourge of humanity. Now, you cannot be friendly with them, obviously, for obvious reasons. But you cannot hate them. So he uses this word three times. Indifference, indifference, indifference. He uses this word three times. You should be totally indifferent. That's what Patanjali recommends. So Maitri, Karuna, Mudita, Ubekshanam, Sukha, Dukha, Punya, Apunya, Vishayanam, Bhavanataha, Chitta, Prasadanam. How do we attain mental serenity, peace and tranquility? By cultivating friendliness, compassion, admiration and indifference towards people suffering from, people who are enjoying happiness, towards them you should be happy, you should feel the happiness within. And those who are sorrowful, you should feel the sorrow within. They are good people, but you feel sorrow for them. And those who are superior to you, you should not be jealous of them. Jealousy also upsets the mind. It kills the inner tranquility and peace. Jealousy is a very big problem. Jealousy is a much bigger problem, according to psychologists, than envy. If you have got envy, well, you may say, well, you have got a color, you have got a black and white TV, your neighbor has got a color TV. So you want to get a color TV. There your envy comes to an end. But if you're jealous, then even if you have to break your own color TV, you want that your neighbor should not have any TV at all. So jealousy is much more destructive. Jealous man can never feel happy unless the person of whom he is jealous is thoroughly, completely destroyed. That's the only thing for him to get an inner peace for. So Patanjali says you should not be jealous or envious of those who are superior to you. That again kills the inner tranquility and peace. And you should be able to feel happiness when others are happy. And you should be able to feel sorrow when others have a bad time, when they are sorrowful. And you should neither be friendly or hostile towards those who are evil by nature, because both like and dislike, attraction and aversion, both disturbs the inner peace, the inner poise, and disturbs the tranquility and peace within. So we'll continue this discussion in the next class. So thank you. After this, of course, we'll have interaction. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. You can have interaction and questions. Discussions, open session.
So, Swami, if we come into conflict, if we see egregious evil, are we to be
Yes, there are two stages in our reaction towards evil. First, righteous indignation, which really virtue. But if you react first in the form of righteous indignation, you reach a stage, you evolve, you graduate to the next stage of evolution. You will be able to show your indignation without your mind being disturbed. The highest form of reaction is reaction without being affected by the reaction. In the spiritual classic, devotion classic, in Bhagavata Purana, there's a description of Lord Krishna. If you read Lord Krishna's life, what all roles he played is mind-boggling. He was a general, he was a philosopher, he was a teacher, and he was a mighty warrior, a king and also a kingmaker. Most of the time, he was busy fighting evil fellows. But then he said, somebody asked him, why is it that you are able to do all this with a smile? When he taught Arjuna, when he taught the great sages and saints, he was smiling. And when he fought with evil men, then also he was smiling. So the answer given is, whatever he did, he was not attached or enslaved by any emotion. Because it was the function that he had to perform. At that stage, one gets established in inner peace and tranquility. But there is another stage before you reach that highest stage of spiritual level, where we give an orientation, a creative, constructive orientation to righteous indignation, when we react. But that reaction, if that reaction gives you greater peace of mind than indifference, it means that we have to react. And through reaction, we have to reach a higher stage where we won't feel the need to react. So, and beyond that stage, you'll be able to react without your mental tranquility and peace being disturbed. So Lord Krishna had reached that stage. That is the description of the Gita. So it depends upon where we stand. Sometimes we feel, well, if we keep quiet, we feel it's wrong. We feel, there is something wrong in my keeping quiet, which means reaction is our path. If you had gone beyond that stage, you won't feel the need, the extreme need to react. That's the point. And after reacting for some time, you will understand. That's how nature teaches the great grand lessons of life. This world cannot be transformed or changed. That's a higher state of wisdom. Lao Tzu makes the statement, you know. When you reach a state of mind where you realize the futility of all actions, all endeavors, then it's all right. But before that, we had to act. Running away from action, avoiding action due to ignorance or cowardice is much more harmful than inaction. Total inaction. So that kind of inaction is really harmful. Through action, we have to evolve to the next stage of action without being disturbed. I shall give, this is an occasion for this. In the Gita, you find four stages in the evolution of Arjuna's mind. In the first chapter, we find a man who was totally disillusioned, who was talking about highest spiritual principles, philosophical truths. But actually, he was a hypocrite. Lord Krishna himself called him Mithyachara, Sauchyade. So he was talking the language of a Buddha, but he was a soldier who was commissioned to protect the good people from evil men, the women folk. Poor people, the weak men. And he was trying to run away from his duties and responsibilities. But he had not become a Buddha or a Christ, but he was talking their language. Total inaction due to lethargy, hypocrisy, and laziness. The next stage of evolution is action, the desire. You get angry towards the evil. You identify yourself with the good. You act for the cause of the good. Next stage in Arjuna's mind. The third stage, Lord Krishna says, you act, but without being enslaved, without being affected by your actions. The karma yoga is called. Action without any attachment. So, we should not imagine that inaction by itself is a great virtue. inaction, if inaction is due to laziness or ignorance, then it is worse than action with desire. And from action to desire, you evolve to the next stage of action, the same action, without desire, without attachment. At that stage, you'll be active, but you won't be affected by that. So you have to combine yoga and Vedanta here. Of course, you have to remember, we have to keep one point in mind, please remember. Yoga system is essentially focusing on individual spiritual practices. So yoga system doesn't present you a philosophy, a total philosophy of life. Yoga system focuses on certain aspects of individual spiritual life. What all problems we have to face when we start our spiritual life, and what all samskaras, tendencies and impressions may emerge in the mind, how they may create problems, how to cope with them. That is what yoga is focusing on. So I have to get out of the jurisdiction of yoga to give an answer to the question you asked. Patanjali doesn't take into consideration the whole aspect of karma yoga or anything. What he says is, if you want to practice yoga, you should do this. And you have to remember, unlike our own times, Patanjali system was taught and meant for people living in isolation, in hermitages, in forest, in solitude, secluded places. In modern times, we are making use of many of these great principles in a different context, of course. So in our inner life, we should be able to try to control the impulse to act and to react immediately. I must react against this. I must act. We should be able to, well, how should you react? Why should you react? Are you going to change the world? Can you completely alter the way the world is being run? You can't do that. So that kind of auto-suggestion is implied in Patanjali system. It's an individual spiritual life that Patanjali is focusing on. But it will help us. See, for example, when we feel unhappy when others are happy, it disturbs the mind. When we are not able to enjoy when others are happy, or when we feel jealousy or envy, or when we feel drawn towards people with negative ideas, all these situations could emerge in our life. So his ideas, Patanjali's idea, upeksha, you should be indifferent towards those who approach you with negative ideas. You should be able to be compassionate towards those who are happy. And you should be able to admire those who are superior to you, higher in spiritual evolution. So all these will help us to keep our mind in a state of tranquility and peace. That's the idea. In our day-to-day interaction with people among whom we live. That's the focus of this sutra. So, Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Dasat Sri Ramakrishna Namaste.